Thank you for listening to the Faith Radio Mornings podcast. Enjoy the conversation.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Let it rise.
Good morning. Thanks for getting your day started with me. Bill Arnold here. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and I've got my cup of dark roast with a little hint of hickory in it, and we're all good to go. You know, we live in a world of nearly 7 billion people. What I don't think you need is another opinion. Oh, I hope I just didn't talk myself out of a job. So let's go to what the Word of God says. In Ephesians chapter 3, it says, starting in verse 17, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power, together with all the Lord's holy people, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. So I pray you are filled this morning as you go about your day. And every day when I come in, I try to sit down with people you'd like to sit down with and have a friendly conversation over a nice cup of coffee. And my first guest this morning is James Carafano. He is going to be on the studio line with us in just a minute. But this month, because it's Ramadan, I signed up for this prayer cast to try to pray for people during this time, our Muslim friends and brothers and sisters. And today I'm supposed to be praying for the people of Afghanistan. And it's 99.9% of Afghans are Muslim. Christianity remains nearly entirely underground, that there is possibly only 1,000 to 3,000 believers in Afghanistan in total. So I'm praying for appropriate and expedient solutions to the ongoing threats of violence in Afghanistan and praying for Afghans who are seeking truth to boldly embrace a new identity in Christ, which would be awfully hard to do if there's only 1,000 to 3,000 believers. And then to pray for protection over the Afghan believers and perseverance despite suffering. So that's what I was praying about this morning. We're going to bring my first guest on, James Carafano. He's on the studio line. In just a minute, we're going to take a break, and when we come back. Good morning. It's 7 minutes after the hour. My first guest, James J. Carafano, is a leading expert in national security and foreign policy challenges. He's from the Heritage Foundation. I would like to just read his entire resume, but that would eat up the next hour. But it's so impressive. I just got to be honest. I read this and I go, Bill, you kind of wasted part of your life, didn't you? But he is a 25-year Army veteran with a master's and doctorate from Georgetown University. He is... Before coming to Heritage, he served as the fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Washington Policy Institute dedicated to defense issues. So when it came to discussing what's going on over in London, I thought, he'd be the perfect guy to talk to. Jim, good morning.
Hey, good to be with you.
Thank you so much. All right, let's get started. What do we know about these terrorists?
Well, here's the deal. Since 9/11, we have seen almost everything. There are many different terrorist vectors, different kinds of attacks, different things. And it's gotten to the point where when we see a terrorist attack, even when we don't have all the full information and information still coming out, inevitably what we've seen is we've seen this act before in one respect or another. And there are a couple of things that constantly come up, which I think are worthy. One is – you know, we tend to always fixate on the tool, right? And I get this all the time. People say, well, is it going to be a dirty bomb or a pipe bomb, right? And what we need to fixate on the terrorists, because no matter what, terrorists are just out to terrorize and kill people. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even matter the number or the tools that they use. And, you know, we live in free societies. We have an almost infinite number of vulnerabilities. So terrorists have almost an infinite number of choices. So there's lots of ways they can come at you, and we've seen this over and over again. And what you want to do is the way you stop terrorist plots is to focus on the terrorists and stop them before they attack and kill people.
Well, Jim, I was just reading that one of the terrorists is linked to an imam in Detroit, that he got radicalized through watching his YouTube videos.
So this is, again, this is something that, we have seen before. You know, you hear a lot about lone wolves, and, you know, and there we see almost zero cases of true lone wolves, which, you know, the guy in the basement radicalizing himself and not talking to anybody.
Right.
Inevitably, what we see is there's a there are connections. Sometimes it's people that know about the plot, participate in the plot, support the plot. So normally there's always a network, and that's kind of really – what you're looking for is to identify the network. The thing about the internet, and I just had this discussion yesterday actually with a British official, is, you know, the internet's global and it reaches all over the world. And yet in many countries where there's every bit as much access to the internet as there is in the UK, it actually results in very few people being radicalized. In the United States, the radicalized population is a couple of thousand out of literally, you know, 320 million people.
Mm-hmm.
What makes the internet important and dangerous is where that social network connects with a human web of people on the ground. And that's something that Great Britain actually has a very big problem, is they actually have a very large population with people that have extremist views and are connected with each other. And that's how views like that and internet stuff like that propagates, because it's essentially – it's seeds falling on fertile ground.
Mm-hmm. Jim, when I was reading about that, there are possibly 23,000 jihadists in the UK right now, and most of them are homegrown. Those are kind of scary numbers.
So I believe that, you know, in part, Europe in general, not just the UK, but Europe, Belgium, France in particular, they, as Muslim immigrants came to those countries over the years, they assimilated very, very different than we are in the United States. I mean, if you look across, I mean, there are exceptions, but if you look across America, Muslims tend to be of very varying different economic orders, you know, low, middle, high class. They tend to disperse geographically, and they tend to not cluster. So, for example, you don't see like all the people from one village go to one town or something. So Muslims are actually very well integrated into American society by and large, which is why if you lay down a map of all the terrorist plots that we have known in the United States and all the cases of material support, it doesn't really match up very well geographically. It's kind of scattershot all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, people tended to cluster. So lower economic order, you know, same geographic location, same communities, and marginalized, not well-integrated civil society. So they tend to be much, much better grounds for radicalization. That's not saying that you know, terrorists are only poor people, because actually what we've seen is economically many, many terrorist people are come from the middle class. But those communities are much more prone to radicalization because, in a sense, they're islands and isolated from society in general. So we see that in the UK. We saw it in places like Malbec in Belgium. We see it in France.
Mm-hmm. Jim, as I'm watching now the third terrorist attack in 3 months, and I'm just trying to evaluate how the UK is handling this, I've come to no conclusions. Can you help me on this?
Well, I mean, so the plus side is, I mean, the UK knows they have a big problem. They've actually been focusing on that problem, and through two ways. One is they actually have been developing counterterrorism programs, which are actually are more effective. I mean, before, the counterterrorism programs were essentially linking to leaders in the communities and saying, okay, you deal with this. And oftentimes, the leaders in the community that they were linking to were people that were leading the extremist radicalization of the community. So there's a move away from that. That's good. And the second thing is they're focusing on kind of the core counterterrorism mission, which is find bad guys and stop them before they hurt people. The problem is there's so many bad guys in the UK that it's a big mix. And even in the UK, I mean, they do have kind of a mixed bag there. I mean, there are leaders like the mayor of London who, look, this guy does not have the security and the interests of the people of London at, I mean, it's just true, at the top of his agenda.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a fact. I mean, you know, he said, well, I'm too busy to worry about Trump because I'm busy taking care of my city. And of course, the next day he launches into a tirade against, you know, Trump and stuff. This guy's a very politicized figure. He is in a sense the kind of the epitome of the problem, which people that do put image and politics and political correctness above actually fighting and getting bad people, and this is a challenge that they struggle with in the UK, and it was a challenge that we've had here. I mean, the only difference between us and the UK is we don't have near the scale of the problem, but what we had in the last 8 years was simply an administration that was so focused on, I mean, I wish we had a better word, but we don't, but this political correctness. And it was more important not to offend anybody than to get the terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kept making this argument, well, we're going to create more terrorists if we offend people. But there's absolutely no empirical evidence for that. So we spent 8 years being nice to people, and we actually have more terror plots in the United States than we've ever had under Obama. The only saving grace why America doesn't have a problem on the scale of Great Britain is we don't have near the size of radical population that they do, and it's harder to get to the United States for mm-hmm. a radical.
Yeah, Jim, I want to take a break. When I come back, I'd like to ask you how this might impact our approach here in the U.S. to fighting terrorism, some of the strategies that we need to work on. I'm talking to James Carafano. Be back in just a minute. Welcome back. It's 18 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to James Carafano from the Heritage Foundation, a man who speaks reality in plain terms, which I appreciate. I also have a feeling when you tell people to get off your lawn, you mean it, don't you?
I don't have a lawn.
Well, that worked out good then. So I'm curious, Jim, how many intelligence people do you need per bad guy?
Well, that's a good question. And if you're actually tailing somebody, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the right word, but you actually have somebody under observation. I think this is a person who might be doing something dangerous. We need to keep it. That's like 20 people.
Wow, that's
right.
You need a lot of manpower, don't you?
Yeah, if you have 23,000, you do the math. And so,
I can't.
Yeah, me neither. So when they say, What you have to do is you have to be able to tap into the network to look for signals that somebody's about to do something. So there's a lot of, you know, in this case about one of the perpetrators in the London attack was somebody that had been known to to British officials, and they had investigated him and they kind of cleared him and move on. And I don't think necessarily you can blame the government for that, because at the time you may not have been actively plotting something.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just follow 23,000 people around the UK, and you can't do preventative detention on 23,000 people. So what you have to be able to do is essentially is to be able to read the network. Which, how do you do that, right? So you have informants that penetrate groups. You have leak, you know, snitches, that kind of stuff. You put people in undercover. Do legal monitoring. You have a presence in the community. And understand what's going on in the community, and you're looking for signals of this kind of stuff. And this is called community policing, and that's actually been kind of a typical problem in many countries in Europe, is that they don't have this tradition of community policing, particularly on these kind of isolated ethnic communities, right? So they don't. The law enforcement don't speak the local language. They don't know the people. They don't go into the streets. I'm not claiming that they're, you know, like no-go zones or something like some people claim. But the fact is that there's not a police presence, and so they're not picking up on these things. And the other thing is essentially they have, you know, again, communities that are not helpful, that don't report suspicious. I mean, in this case, we did actually have some reports, but in some cases, people don't report suspicious activities, and that's a problem.
Now, some of the neighbors to one of the attackers apparently had a lot of crazy talk, and the neighbors were
right.
aware of it, but
right.
they didn't. I don't know, did they report or not? Because you don't really want to. They don't want to look to be like an Islamophobe, right?
Well, so again, this is preliminary, so we don't have everything. So, you know, we don't want to, you know, run and draw conclusions. I mean, there are press reports that, there were comments and activity that was reported to the police. So we'll see. The Islamophobia thing is, look, you know, we have a thing in the States. It's called see something, say something.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the idea behind that is if you see or hear something that you think is a threat to public safety, what you do is you take that to a responsible official and you share that with them. It could be the security guard in your building. It could be the cop on the corner. It could be calling an FBI tip line or something. But you as a citizen report, say, hey, this is something that doesn't look right to me. A suspicious package, you know, a confluence of people meeting somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, you've then done your responsibility as a citizen. Nobody is asking you to make a judgment on people.
Okay.
Nobody is asking you to make any – because you're not. You're not law enforcement. You're not a public safety official. You don't know what's right and wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you're not violating anybody's civil rights or civil liberties. You're turning that information over to a responsible official, and they're qualified and the appropriate person to do an assessment and decide, is this a problem or not? So that's not being – Islamophobic or racist or xenophobic or anything else. That's just doing what you do as a citizen. And I actually think that's a good valid way to go. And if you look at the overwhelming number of terrorist plots that we had in the United States since 9/11, most of them have been thwarted. Many of them were stopped by – well, actually all of them that were stopped by lawful investigations, lawful operations, and in some cases, the help and assistance of people in communities.
Mm-hmm. Jim, what advice would you be giving President Trump and Prime Minister May in the middle of all this?
Well, I don't have to give them much advice. The U.S. and U.K. have a very strong counterterrorism relationship. That's something that is not in jeopardy. I know you probably saw press reports about, oh, we sure can't share intelligence from the United States and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
None of that's true. That's one of the most robust relationships we have. I think if there is a area where we kind of need to crosstalk, it's on what do we do about not kind of the classic counterterrorism operations, which is, you know, go out and actively find people who are actively involved in wanting to kill people. But in this issue about how do you deal with people who are in this gray zone where they're espousing extremist voices and activities, some of that which may be legitimate protected free speech, and they're on the cusp of crossing over into a criminal activity or terrorist activity or material support for terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the previous administration had a term for that. They call it countering violent extremism. The problem with that term is it's completely meaningless. It was denuded of focus on the primary national security threat, which is radical, you know, Islamist terrorism, and it was more of a bumper sticker. And we need to get beyond that. I mean, we have a global threat with ISIS and Al Qaeda. I get that, but it doesn't manifest itself everywhere in the globe. What's going on in London looks nothing like what's going on in New York City, which looks nothing like what's going on in India or Australia or other places. And you have to really particularize your efforts in the place that you're at. So this kind of global program, which is meaningless, we spent a lot of money, it was mostly for show, and it was mostly to soothe Obama's politics or anything else, that needs to get thrown out the window. So what's that replaced with? And that's where I think there's something for a very kind of useful discussion between the U.S. and Britain, both countries that have a lot of experience and a lot of interest in that. And so that's an area where I think that the two leaders can work on stuff.
Jim, you are my kind of guy. I could hang with you.
That's what my wife says, which is, you know, that's a good thing.
That is a good thing. I just so appreciate, we've just got about 30 seconds left here. You know, how might we do something? You know, what is the one thing the person in the car driving to work could be aware of as they go about hearing this news?
Look, at the end of the day, what fights terrorism and poverty and crime and everything else are strong, resilient communities and strong, resilient families. So when we build good families, when we build good communities, we fight all kinds of problems, terrorism included. So everybody is a counterterrorism expert. You know, everybody is – it's about making your community healthy and making your family healthy. That's the two best things we can do. Those are the best things we can do for our country.
Well said. Thank you so much, Jim. Have a great day.
All right, good talking to you.
All right,
bye-bye.
Thanks. That's Jim Carafano. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a minute. Good morning, 29 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here. Kristen Hawkins is going to be our guest. She's the president of Students for Life America. We're going to talk to her just after the news break. So let's hear some news now. Good morning, 25 minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here. Titus 2, 11 to 12 says, "For the grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all people. It teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age." Pastor Ray Hollenbach shares how this passage impacted his life and what it teaches us about God's grace.
I met the Lord a long time ago as a 15-year-old when I was in high school, and I experienced salvation. Jesus paid a price that I could never pay. And we know from the scriptures that we're saved by grace through faith. But for the longest time, until I really saw this passage in Titus, I didn't realize that grace not only saves us, but the passage in Titus tells us that it does two other things. So first it saves, but then it teaches us how to say no to ungodliness. And then finally, it teaches us how to live sensible, upright lives in this present age. So the grace of God is going to show me the way to heaven, but the grace of God's also going to help me here on earth.
If you want to hear that full interview, go to our website, myfaithradio.com. Search Deeper Grace. You will arrive at the location, Pastor Ray Hollenbach. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Kristen Hawkins, President for Students for Life America.
Words matter. Your words really matter. And the words written and spoken to advance God's kingdom matter most of all. This is Jim Garlow. Our great temptation as Christians is to think our words, whether spoken or written, don't amount to much. You couldn't be more wrong. Psalm 102 verse 18 in the Message says, "Write this down for the next generation so people not yet born will praise God." In the 4th century, a single word mattered enough that it caused the Bishop of Alexandria to be deposed and exiled. A word so important that it caused the Emperor Constantine to convene a council of the church to consider its meaning. That word was incarnation, that the person of Jesus Christ was both completely God and man. And the document produced by that council, the Nicene Creed, is now read each week in many churches all over the world. Words matter. Your words matter. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Minutes until the top of the hour. Good morning. I have on the studio line Kristen Hawkins. She's president of Students for Life. I had to get that out there for a minute. And I was just reading her bio, and she graduated valedictorian from her high school. So we have a lot in common. She was valedictorian, and I was not. So, Kristen, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me today.
You paid attention in school, didn't you?
I tried to.
You did a good job. You've been pro-life and an advocate for the preborn even since high school, haven't you?
That's right. That's how I first got my start working in the pro-life movement.
Tell me how you got your love and passion for this. Where did all this come from?
I began volunteering at a pregnancy resource center. A woman at my church knew I was looking for, you know, something to do over the summer when I was in high school. And she said, "You know, I work at this women's center. Would you like to come and be my intern?" And I didn't really know what a pregnancy resource center was, but I soon found out.
Yeah. So you then got sort of more and more involved, and you ended up now being president of an organization called Students for Life. Tell our listening audience about that.
Yeah, so when I first started volunteering at the Pregnancy Resource Center, I just couldn't believe what was happening. I couldn't believe that abortion was happening every single day all around me, but yet we never talked about it. We never spoke about it at my church. It never came up at school. So I went back to my high school the following year, and I started a Students for Life group, and I started one in college. And then I began, after I graduated college, a friend of mine called and said, what would you think about launching a national organization that would help other young pro-life students to start groups and educate their peers about abortion? And so I kind of just said, yeah, let's do that. Let's take everything I learned in high school and college and make all the mistakes I made trying to organize events and bring people to the truth, and let's fix that. And let's go out, and we kind of took a political campaign style approach of going campus to campus, kind of like how campaigns go door to door. We went campus by campus, and we just asked students, are you pro-life? Are you against abortion? Do you want to stand with us? We want to help you start a Students for Life group. And students were like, yeah, let's do that. And we walked students through that. Today we serve more than 1,200 groups on campuses across the country, high school, college. We just launched into middle schools this fall. We're in every state of the nation. What you've seen is a result of the Holy Spirit being alive in the pro-life movement and just seeing a generation that views abortion differently than their parents have.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, I would certainly say God has raised you up for this work. I mean, your instant answer of yes, let's do a national campaign is just inspiring, my friend. Because
yeah.
I'm looking at these numbers. I just have to brag up this a little bit, because what God has been doing since 2006, now you have gone from 181 groups in the U.S. to 1,031 in all 50 states. And your national conference has gone from 450 to 2,000 in 2015. This event is the largest pro-life conference in the nation. Do you sleep?
Oh, yeah, I do sleep. Not as much as I would like to sometimes, but, you know, it is about saying yes. And I often, when I'm speaking to groups across the country, that's a lot of times that's my main message of saying yes to the Holy Spirit. Being courageous enough just to say yes, because that's, I think, a lot of times the most difficult part of being willing to kind of change the plans you've made for yourself and put yourself in the Holy Spirit's hands and let the Holy Spirit lead you. And I think that's scary, but it's also, if you do it, you're going to be in store for an incredible ride.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, tell me what it's like if you're a college person and you're pro-life. What is it like to be on campus and to be pro-life?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's a lot easier, I think, today to be pro-life on campus than in the 1990s or even in the 1980s. You know, support for abortion is at its all-time low. It can be difficult, though, at times, because I think, you know, what we see a lot on campuses is our biggest pushback comes from professors. It comes from administrators. So, you know, when I was a pro-life student on campus, I went to a very small college. You know, I was one of 12 in my classes, a very small class sizes. So everybody knew where you stood on issues.
Mm-hmm.
I was in political science. We would debate things all the time. And often it was kind of me versus the professor and the rest of the class. So that was difficult. And
yeah.
I had to work even harder.
Yeah.
Because I knew I was going to be called upon and I was going to have to defend whatever actions of whatever conservative politician happened the day before. And I think, you know, it can be challenging at times, but it also gives you a chance to have a lot of really great conversations. One thing that I think a lot of our student groups do so well is really starting the dialogue on campuses with their friends, with their peers, about what is abortion, how abortion really harms women, how it takes the life of a precious, unique, whole human being. We also do a lot of work with our Students for Life groups in particular about where are the resources available on campus for pregnant and parenting students. You know, all these students and professors might say that they're pro-choice, but what they really mean is they're pro-abortion, because there's not a lot of resources on campus for her to choose life. And we want to make it so she doesn't ever have to choose between the life of her child and her education. And that's a great conversation to get started on campus. It's one that a lot of even folks who might not agree with us on abortion, we find that it's a really great way to start building kind of middle ground with folks to say, well, will you at least have a discussion with us about this?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you at least believe we should do this?
Yeah, and I bet their response reluctantly might be, well, yeah, I agree with you there.
If unless they're a hardened pro-abortion advocate, yes, they will. It gets them. If they're a hardened pro-abortion advocate, then nothing we say will, you know,
that's true.
Change their mind. And that's why it's so important. Like as we go out into the world, and you know, all of us who are thinking about how can we make a difference in the pro-life movement, I think sometimes we get, you know, we might get into Facebook debates or, you know, with somebody who's a hardcore pro-abortion supporter. You got to think about who are you trying to reach? We're trying to reach that mushy middle.
Mm-hmm.
We're not trying to reach like the 9% of Americans who believe abortion should be available all 9 months, no matter what, taxpayer funded. We're trying to reach those people who say, well, I wouldn't have an abortion, but I don't think we can tell someone else not to. We're trying to reach that mushy middle pro-choice crowd and get them to choose, to say, look, you can't say abortion's bad for you, but it's okay for somebody else. Either it's wrong, either it's morally wrong, or it's morally okay. Which one is it?
Mm-hmm.
And that those are the people that we're trying to win over.
Kristen, I picture you arguing with your college professor, and I'm thinking, no, that's called life training and preparation, which you've done well. And here you are doing what God's called you to do. Okay, we're going to take a little break because we need to. But when we come back, I want to ask you about some of the results of the Planned Parenthood's annual report. And then I want to talk about this student from Maryland, this Maddie Runkles, who is graduating, and some of the attention she's received in the media. So it is 15 minutes until the top of the hour. I promise we're going to be right back. Good morning. It's almost 10 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm talking to Kristen Hawkins, and she is for President of Students for Life, and what a mission she has been on. And Kristen, I want to ask you about the Planned Parenthood's annual report. Were they putting that off? Were they trying to hide some things?
That's what we think. I mean, Planned Parenthood normally releases their annual report in December, beginning of January. This year, they waited till late May.
Mm-hmm.
And their annual report is always kind of a year behind. So the report they just released was 2015-2016. And I can see why they wanted to put it off. It furthers the narratives that we've been saying in the pro-life movement for years, that as their government funding goes up, their services go down, their abortions go up. The more money they get, the more abortions they commit, and the less preventative services they provide. So compared to their previous annual report, when we're looking this year, we can see that over the course of 1 year, their government funding increased about $1 million. Their abortions increased by 4,000, more than 4,500 abortions. Their cancer screenings decreased by about 17,000. Their pap tests, breast exams decreased about 20,000. The clients they serve decreased by 100,000. The prenatal services, the very few prenatal services that they actually do offer, decreased by 8,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really interesting. You look from year to year, you can see that the narrative is true, is that the more money they get from us, the taxpayers, the more abortions they commit, and the fewer preventative services they provide. And that goes against everything what, you know, Cecile Richards, what Planned Parenthood says in the media. They make the case of they need government funding because they provide preventative services, not because they commit abortions. And that's just not true. We don't need them. We have more than 13,000 federally qualified health centers out there across the country that are true nonprofits that don't put $38 million into an election cycle, that serve 10 times the amount of people that Planned Parenthood serves, that do way more, you know, perform way more services than Planned Parenthood, including they actually perform mammograms, they're the ones that should be getting our taxpayer dollars, not Planned Parenthood.
Mm-hmm. I also found this interesting that Planned Parenthood also added to the report two new categories, woman exams and miscarriage care, but they do not explain anything.
That's right. And the miscarriage care is something that we particularly began speaking out about as soon as we saw this.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is something where Abby Johnson, a good friend of mine, she's a former Planned Parenthood director. She was the director of Planned Parenthood College Station, Texas. She has since, you know, become a pro-life advocate. She has spoken publicly about what's Planned Parenthood's plan for when abortion becomes illegal, for how to handle committing abortions on the sly, not really publicly advertising it. And she actually used that term, miscarriage management, and said that was part of Planned Parenthood's plan. So in states where they weren't allowed to commit abortions at a certain age range, a gestational age of the baby, or, you know, if states would ban abortion, you know, entirely, they had this term in place, and it was, you know, telling the girl, go home, go to the internet, Google how to have a miscarriage, and then come back and we'll make sure that the baby's expelled. And I think that's interesting that we saw that for the first time on the annual report. Obviously, no pro-lifer is against helping women who are having miscarriage. I mean, miscarriages, I've had many friends who've had miscarriages.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most awful experiences that you can go through as a woman, as a family. But for Planned Parenthood to suddenly start offering this and using that term, knowing what we know from Abby,
mm-hmm.
knowing that states are passing more restrictive language now, there's many states now across the country where abortions have been banned after 20 weeks, and that happened during this time that the senior report is dealing with. I think we really need to pay attention to that number, and really need to call on Planned Parenthood to show us what does that term mean. What states were those miscarriage managements provided in? Was that provided in a state where abortions banned after 20 weeks?
Mm.
Was that, you know, and I think we need to ask questions. Someone needs to call them in, you know, House of Representatives, since we pay them, can call them to testify. And that's something they need to answer for publicly.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, we just have a few minutes left. I'd like to talk about the Maddie Runkle story. She was a high school senior who got pregnant, and there was she attended a Christian school. Maybe you can fill in the rest of the blanks.
Yeah, so Maddie got pregnant. She was a 4.0 student, president of student council, made a mistake, engaged in premarital sex, which she knew was wrong, became pregnant. The school had a code of an honor code, and so she went to her principal, acknowledged that she had broken the honor code by having sex. She received a 2-day unofficial suspension, removal from leadership positions, which was common with other students who had broken the honor code, students who had drank or, you know, gotten arrested. However, the school kind of went above and beyond here. The principal then called an all-school assembly with parents, teachers, students, and was going to publicly tell everyone that Maddie had had sex and she was pregnant. Maddie volunteered to go and do it herself. To out herself to everyone, admit her sins. And then the school said, well, in addition, you're not going to be allowed to walk in graduation. And her dad, actually, Scott, was the president of the school board. And so, wait a minute, this seems a little different. We've had students who've been arrested, and they were still able to graduate and walk across graduation. The school said no. So we started working with Maddie this spring. I have reached out to the school. I personally asked them, you know, can we reconsider a policy? We're really concerned. We understand Maddie sinned. She's been punished for that. but the pregnancy is not a sin. And we need to show all the other young women at this school that Maddie's not being punished for courageously choosing life, because what we're concerned about is you had a school assembly, and it kind of sent a signal to every girl at that school, it's better just to have the abortion so no one will know, and this won't happen to you. We need you all to stand with her. We need you to show her grace. The school said, no, we went public, and the story got a lot of media attention. And it was interesting, you know, it really struck a chord. You would not believe the stories that have come into us of people who said, yeah, I went to a Christian school, and I had an abortion because I knew that was going to happen to me, too. I actually had a woman come up to me at Maddie's graduation party. I was there on Saturday. We had an all-term graduation ceremony. Her church had planned for her. I spoke. Then we had a reception, and Students for Life presented Maddie with it. We presented her the college scholarship. You know, a woman, one of Maddie's friends, moms, and Maddie doesn't even know this, came up to me crying, saying, I just want to thank you for taking this story public. I'm so proud of Maddie. I wish I would have done that when I was 18 instead of having my abortion. But it was the same deal. I was going to Christian school. I knew what the punishment was going to be. And I think it's a hard topic to discuss,
mm-hmm.
because how do we as Christians talk about the sin of premarital sex and not encourage young people to do that, to go and make these unhealthy decisions that we know are bad for them. But at the same time, how do we encourage those who courageously choose life? And how are we careful not to shame women who become pregnant because of premarital sex? The premarital sex is a sin. The pregnancy is not a sin. And it's something that we as Christians, this is our problem. Abortion is a Christian problem. The majority of women who have abortions are Christian. More than 40% of women who go to have an abortion say that they are a monthly church goer. If Christians would stop having abortions, we wouldn't have abortion. We have to learn how to deal with this and have these hard conversations.
Yeah. Kristen, this is so interesting. I'd love to talk more, but we do have to go. But thank you for being a guest. Thank you for your work and your courage and doing what God's called you to do. It is 3 minutes until the top of the hour. I'll take a short break and be right back. All right. It's almost a couple minutes until the top of the hour. Good morning. So nice to have you with us. It is Tuesday, and we are very glad you're with us. We're going to talk to Mike Bechtel. He's the author of People Can't Drive You Crazy If You Don't Give Them the Keys. We'll be back in just a
minute. Thank you for listening to this conversation from Faith Radio Mornings. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings. Also, take a moment to subscribe to this podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a show.